Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. My guest today is returning author and New Books Network host, Stephen Lee Naish. We discuss his new book, Screen Captures, Film in the Age of Emergency, published in 2021 by New Star Books. In a series of essays, Stephen discusses various topics and reviews films related to each. Written during the pandemic, he also talks about the current state of film. Welcome, Stephen Lee Naish. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Hi, Joel. Nice to see you again.
Yes, we've actually talked to each other two other times, and then you've also been on the New Books Network with another one of your books, all of which are listed in the show notes in case anyone wants to go back and listen to some of your previous appearances. In addition, you've done some recording as a host for the New Books Network in the music section. So those are out there too, if anybody wants to listen to them. But we're here to talk about your new book, Screen Captures, Film in the Age of Emergency, published in 2021 by New Star Books. We're talking towards the end of September, and the book's scheduled to be published in the next week or so. But as we've already discussed before we started, there are clearly publishing paper issues that are causing most books to be a little late. So, although I suspect if you're the right person, like I think Bob Woodward's book came out on time yesterday, so I suspect we're just not on the same level. But anyway, so what we're going to do is talk a little bit about you and touch a little bit on your previous books, and then we'll get into this book as well. So I hope we have a good conversation.
Yeah, thanks very much, Joel.
Okay, so Stephen Lee Naish, you are in Canada. You were born in the United Kingdom, am I correct?
You are indeed, yes. I was born in the city of Leicester in the Midlands.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your background. As I say, you've been with me before, but and you've probably given a lot of this already, but never assume that that people have listened to past episodes, because the thing with podcasts is people join on whenever they do. So it's not unusual for people to sort of come and go. So talk a little bit about what led you to want to write about film or to study film.
Yeah, sure. So, thanks again for having me on. And I'll try not to repeat myself too much in this part of the introduction. But I grew up in Leicester in the United Kingdom. I was born there and I lived there until about the age of 31, when I moved here to Canada with my wife and our kid. And back in Leicester, I grew up on a council estate just outside of the city of Leicester. And council estate here, for American listeners, might just be sort of like socialized housing, basically. And I was just, a kid into film and into like pop culture of the sort of 1980s and 1990s. And that's reflected quite a bit in the writing that I do. I wasn't particularly a great student, so I didn't really do so well at school, but I left school at 16 and worked for a little while. And I worked in my first ever job was working as a packer for a camera store. So I was handling all this camera equipment, camcorders and editing software and things like that. And by proxy, I kind of just figured all this stuff out. And then a couple of years into that, I realized that I didn't really want to be a packer for the rest of my life. So decided that I would go back to college and study the things that I was kind of interested in, which at that time, being sort of 18 years old, was mostly just kind of music and clothes. But, I went and I studied
media. Like
most
18-year-olds.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty amazing to be a 16, 17 year old with a full-time job and just so much disposable income that I could go out every week and buy, free new records, a bunch of new shirts, new jeans, and still have money left over. I wish I'd saved more money when I was younger there. But, anyway, so I, uh, I went to study media at Leicester College, and my initial feelings were that I really wanted to be maybe write about music. So music journalism was kind of the thing that I was really into at that time. I was a big reader of music magazines like the NME and Melody Maker and things like that, and just going to see bands every couple of weeks and just really enjoying that. So I went and I did a year, and then I did another 2 years. And while I was there, I got to make films as well. And we got to talk about films in class. And it was just really, really fascinating. And the people that I was at college with were obviously really kind of film obsessives as well. So my dwindling disposable income kind of went on VHS cassettes as opposed to CDs and records. And I kind of like built up a little film collection of VHS cassettes just as they were dying out and being replaced by DVD. So they were always super cheap. You could always go to Virgin Megastore and pick up a VHS cassette for like £2, equivalent of maybe $2 or something like that. And then I got into kind of like filmmaking. When I left college, I went to work at a regular job, went to work for a bookstore. But on the side, as a kind of like side hustle, I would go out with my $150 camcorder and go and film bands that were visiting Leicester and bands that were already kind of in Leicester and developed a kind of reputation as the guy who would kind of film your band while you were playing live for relatively little money, if any. Maybe just a few beers or something like that was usually what I would ask for. You know, if I'm there, I'll take a couple of beers from the bar and I'll film your band and edit the footage together for you, and you can use it on your MySpace page and things like that. So I kind of did that for a few years and really enjoyed it. But you know, you get to the age of like, you know, 27, 28, and you realize that hanging out in like smoky back rooms and at 2 o'clock in the morning isn't really gonna be sustainable. So I ended up sort of like leaving behind filmmaking, but still really very passionate about film itself. And what I really wanted to do was write about film, but use film as a lens to look at wider issues of politics and pop culture and society and technology and things like that. And so I went back to college. I studied with the Open University, which is a bi-correspondence university in the UK. Had just a really great experience of doing that. I studied politics. I studied creative writing. I studied essay writing. And then I sort of began in the background again, just still working, but writing about film and planning, you know, the possibility of putting a book together on Dennis Hopper, who was my man back then. And that book actually did come together and was released in 2016 by Amsterdam University Press. And me and Joel discussed that a few years ago. And and then, you know, the move to Canada kind of happened. And when I arrived in Canada, I wasn't really able to work for a few months. So I had all this stuff circulating around my head about sort of film, and I had some time to write it because I couldn't work for a couple of months. So I would just sort of take some time with a laptop and just try and bash out a bunch of essays as quick as possible, and started submitting them places and gathered a publication history online. And that kind of led me to my first book called USA, Politics and Humanity in American Film, which came out in 2014 with Zero Books, which was always kind of an ambition of mine to publish with Zero Books, actually, because when I was a bookstore worker, I would see their books come in every couple of weeks and always be really intrigued by their titles. So it was really great to be published by them. And yeah, that kind of led me to then publish the book on Dennis Hopper and then a book on Dirty Dancing a few years after that. And then I took a little break from film writing in the last couple of years to concentrate on writing a little bit about music, going back to sort of what I initially wanted to do, like back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and do some music writing. So I wrote a book about, I wrote two books about a band called the Manic Street Preachers. They're a Welsh punk band, turned stadium rock band, one of the most popular bands in the United Kingdom. In fact, as we're talking right now, they've just released a new record and it's just hit the number one spot in the United Kingdom. So they've been going for like 30 odd years and they're still, you know, racking up number one albums. So they're still a very, very popular band. So that was really great. You know, I got to sort of write about them and have some really cool experiences of just sort of talking about the Manics. And but, you know, this collection of essays, which has been kind of put together into screen captures, has kind of always been on the background for the last few years as well. I mean, even when I was writing about music, I was writing about film as well. So, yeah, that kind of, I mean, that kind of brings you up to date of where I am right now, I suppose, Joel.
So the book is a series of essays, not all of which, I mean, they're all written by you, obviously, but not necessarily first for this book. But you've already pointed out that you do quite a bit of writing in various places. What is the oldest essay in this book, if you don't mind me asking?
I think the oldest essay comes from about 2014, actually. I think I wrote maybe one or two of them kind of in support of the very first book. But, you know, just kind of like everything, you know, they've kind of been lost to the internet a little bit. And, but I'm still very like proud of those pieces and wanted to sort of get them out, even though they were kind of, were out at one point, but kind of lost. So, you know, this, what we decided to do, or what initially I wanted to do anyway, was, I submitted, the manuscript kind of just as a collection of essays, and it was kind of sparse and random. But, you know, the publisher of this book, New Star, publishers who are based out of Vancouver, kind of suggested, you know, why don't you like smash some of these essays together? Why don't you create some new writing around them? Why don't you bring them up to date? You know, we're dealing with a pandemic right now. Why don't we sort of like bring this in? So even like, you know, an essay that was published in 2014 when the world seemed a little calmer before Trump, before Brexit, before COVID, still kind of resonates today. So we kind of just brought it up to date a little bit.
So some of the are any of the essays as they originally were written, or have you pretty much updated all of them?
I pretty much updated all of them. I think maybe there's one essay which I think we'll probably end up talking about, which is on the American Pie franchise. That pretty much exists in the book as it existed when it was first published online. But again, it was kind of one of those essays that was, you know, published back in 2014, maybe, and kind of just lost on the internet, you know. So I'm quite proud of that essay and wanted to sort of get it out there again. And I think it actually resonates even more than it did back in 2014, actually.
I know at the end of the book, at the end of the entire book, you have a list of where all of these were originally published, at least in one form or another. So, and then are any brand new to this collection, or which ones are? Because I assume at least a couple of them are new.
Yeah, there are a few new ones in there. The very last essay titled The Slow Dissolve is entirely brand new. The introduction to the book as well is all new ideas in there.
And I assume the afterword too.
Yeah. Exactly. The concluding kind of essay as well, because that really does kind of bring in the COVID-19 pandemic as well. But yeah, and then throughout the sort of the essays, there's kind of like connecting bridges, which are like brand new, that kind of bring the essay into sort of today's light. So, yeah.
So the subtitle of the book is Film in the Age of Emergency. I assume that's what we're talking about, but what your publisher and you've already, what you've mentioned is that a lot of the ideas and where you're trying to write about relate to present day, particularly with the pandemic and other kinds of emergencies. Is that really what your plan was?
Yeah, I think the subtitle kind of came a little later, actually. I feel like we're dealing with so many emergencies. I mean, I don't know where what you've been experiencing this past summer, but here in Canada, we've had some of the craziest weather events. I mean, I'm in a relatively calm place in Ontario, but we've seen some incredible storms here. But across Canada, you know, wildfires, floods across the world, more floods and droughts. It's really been an awful summer for weather events and climate catastrophe. And I feel that obviously that's kind of like the overriding emergency right now. But then, yes, on top of that, we also have the COVID-19 pandemic. But I think, you know, this is like, to me, this is like whack-a-mole. You know, these are all just side effects, I think, of a larger emergency, which is that of, you know, neoliberalism, capitalism, the way that we've shaped our world for profit. And I feel that is probably the biggest emergency that I feel that we face. And we can't deal with the climate emergency. We can't really deal with COVID-19 unless we face that issue of unfettered capitalism, basically.
Yeah, I live in northeastern Kentucky, and I must admit, we don't, weather-wise, the biggest issue we had was in February. We had an incredible ice storm, which most people around here said they've never seen anything like it. We were out of power for 2 weeks. Ice was every place. You couldn't even get anywhere. It was just ridiculous. I mean, we don't usually get a lot of snow. We get some cold weather, but not snow. And yet this was just pure ice all over the place. And it was like 4 days before the temperature got back above freezing, or actually even a little longer. And so that happened, and that was unusual. Of course, around here, I'm also living in an area where the other two big issues for us in the United States have been very important. Obviously, the most current one is the pandemic, where I'm definitely living in an area where there is a certain group of people who aren't particularly interested in vaccinations or this vaccination. And then, of course, then we have the folks who supported the last United States president, and still many of them still claiming that he's still the president or should be. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to get into any of that, but it gives you a little bit of sense of what I deal with here. And then, of course, I have friends and relatives in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I'm from. And we haven't gone up there very much because of the pandemic, but we were up there a couple of months ago, and it was very interesting to be in an area that's got a different point of view, and found it very interesting as a comparison. And not that we're not happy where we are. We're here for my wife's job, but there's no question that there are days where we sort of miss the slightly different point of view that we get up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really rough. I remember reading and seeing images of that ice storm, because I do have a friend who is in that area as well, and I was concerned about them. But yeah, I mean, that was just the starting pistol for this year's intense weather. I think it's finally put it on the map a little bit, you know, like put it on people's agendas a little bit. But I mean, over here in Canada, we've just voted, you know, we've just had our federal election, and we've just voted in the Liberal Party under Justin Trudeau. And it's just the same old, you know, we're not going to be going anywhere with this Liberal government. They're not going to be initiating any major changes in policy that will positively affect the climate. It's only going to be continuation of what they see the continuation of their neoliberalist point of view, I suppose. We had an opportunity, I suppose, to vote in a progressive government with the NDP here in Canada, but we didn't. So one day we might, but we're running out of time. So that's kind of the emergency that the we're dealing with, and that's kind of the book takes those emergencies and slams them through the lens of film. So,
well, we're not going to discuss every essay, obviously. I forgot, I didn't count, so you can tell me when I see 1, 2, 3. It's 12 essays, I think, and then afterwards. So it's
That's about right. Yeah.
So they're obviously, people like hearing me count over the internet. So anyway, luckily I grouped them in threes. That's how I learned to do math.
That's
anyway,
exactly right.
So we're going to talk a few about a few of them. Some are ones that I've particularly found interesting, and then there's a couple that you wanted to particularly talk about. So hopefully we'll give people a taste of what's in here so they know, get a better sense of what your writing plan was. Mm-hmm. And the first chapter is Star Wars Accelerationism, and that's right at the beginning, so I think it's a good one to start with, because usually when you write anything or film or anything, whatever's first is in music for that matter, first mm-hmm. tends to be very important, because it's how you start off, it's how you grab the reader. And so I think the Star Wars chapter is very good place to start. And when did you, is this, I'm assuming this is somewhat older, but you go all the way to the last film, you know, the last official film. So what's the genesis of this chapter?
It's a really good question. And it's such a vast chapter that I'm not 100% sure even I know what it's all about. But I really did try to cram as much ideas in there as possible, because I'm a huge fan of Star Wars, and I have been for many, many years. I was kind of late to it. I really didn't get into it until the prequel trilogy back in the late 90s and early 2000s. But I was just so super excited about, you know, this idea of a sequel trilogy with new characters and things like that. And, you know, Disney's kind of takeover obviously concerned me a little bit, but I thought I would just sweep that aside and enjoy you know, reminiscing about Star Wars, but also embracing this kind of new idea of Star Wars, which I mean, just didn't really come to pass. You know, the chapter itself is called Star Wars Accelerationism, and I think that ultimately, when you look at the sequel trilogy, the films of you know, The Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, and The Rise of Skywalker, it's this race to the finish line. I mean, it really is this idea of trying to push out three films as fast as possible.
Because they came out every 2 years instead of the original ones, which were three.
Yeah, that's right. That's one thing that obviously is different. But you've also got to take into account the sort of teaser effect as well of these films that always start about a year before. The internet is a big deal now as well. I mean, it was obviously well used back in the early 2000s as well, but now every YouTuber and every blogger can decipher every single morsel of information that's out there. And some YouTubers and podcasters are making a living now out of Star Wars theories and delving into sort of Star Wars lore. So it's become kind of like its own little cottage industry on the side. But I really feel like with this particular trilogy of films, that there was no plan from Disney. Each film kind of reacts to the other one with no real coherence. And so when I got to review the final film, The Rise of Skywalker, which came out in December 2019, which seems like a lifetime ago now, and
because in many ways it was just before the pandemic.
Yeah, I feel like I've aged maybe 4 or 5 years as opposed to just two from that perspective. But I got to say, I was just super, super disappointed. You know, there was elements of narrative in The Last Jedi, which I thought made Star Wars which I think points Star Wars in a more progressive way, or more progressive direction. And then The Rise of Skywalker kind of just scrapped that completely and just went full on adventure film, and really just unsatisfying conclusion. But it wasn't just the fact of this unsatisfying conclusion to a trilogy of films. It's obviously the concluding chapter of a 9-film arc that we are meant to sort of watch from The Phantom Menace all the way through to The Rise of Skywalker. And I've never done it. I've done 6 films back to back. I've never done the 9 films, and I can't imagine what it would feel like to get to the end of that, to get to the end of those 9 films and be faced with this inconclusive movie that doesn't push anything forward. And also then I got to thinking, like, and I do this in the chapter to some length, you know, what is going on in the Star Wars universe now, like after this film has, after this story has kind of wrapped up? Because, you know, the galaxy far, far away does not seem like it's in a very good place after this film. You know, we've had a trilogy of this kind of quasi empire, the rise of that, and then its fall. And we have at the very end of that film, spoilers, but, you know, there's all these ships that show up to fight the remnants of the empire and this First Order. And we don't know who these people are. They could be scoundrels of the worst kind, pirates, bounty hunters. Some of them we definitely know are assassins and bounty hunters because we meet them earlier on in the film. So it kind of comes to this conclusion that the galaxy is kind of just going off in this strange place of no real unity. There's no Jedi. There's no leadership from any of the previous films. And that leaves me deeply unsatisfied. And I think it probably left a lot of people unsatisfied as well. As a standalone movie, or even as a start of a new trilogy, it would probably be a good way to begin, but a good way to end, it's not. And so that chapter kind of deals with that a little bit. It kind of deals with the fandom as well. You know, there's a lot of sort of toxic fandom in the Star Wars communities that kind of have reared their ugly head over The Last Jedi, but also over the Rise of Skywalker as well. And it just seems very reminiscent of what is happening within the film. You know, all these different, you know, fighters at the end of the film don't really have any unifying ideology or anything like that. So it's a mess. And so the fandom's a mess and the films are now a bit of a mess as well. I will say though that Disney has done a pretty good job at the TV productions, which I don't really cover too much in the book. They're mentioned, but again, it's the start, it's the accelerationism of everything that Disney has done. They pushed out 5 movies in the space of 5 years, a 2-season TV show,
and a bunch of animated things.
Yes,
yeah, so.
A bunch of animated shows. So there's a lot of Star Wars content out there, and I think the best way for it to move forward is probably just through streaming now, through television and through streaming, because the movies are pretty much dead in the water now, I think. Yeah, enjoyable experience watching it at the movie theater, but at the same time, I did just come out feeling totally defeated. And yeah, so that chapter kind of does deal with that a little bit. My own personal sort of disappointments. But on the bigger picture, the sort of the idea that, like, if you could just have a plan and then stick with it, you might have just actually developed a decent film. Or if you're going to cast minority actors, how about you let them see their character arc all the way through rather than kind of dismiss them in the sort of next film, you know? Just a huge mess. So, yeah, Star Wars accelerationism kind of starts the book off slightly pessimistic, but there is a lot more hope in the book itself.
Well, we can always use a new hope, so that's good. I must admit, one of the things that you said that I definitely agree with is that the biggest problem with the last 3 movies is that there wasn't an overall person in charge. George Lucas, yeah. You can complain all you want about aspects of what he did and how he changed things and his lack of reasonably good writing skills, at least dialogue and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is you knew it was unified. And, yes. You know, as far as that part is concerned, now I go to Star Wars all the way back. I was 19 years old when Star Wars came out. And there's no question in my – actually 21. Sorry about that. I can't do my math. One of the things that I always remembered was as each film came out, you kept saying, okay – did I like it? So, for example, everybody loved Star Wars, but then when Empire came out, everybody says, oh my, he did better. Of course, remember back then, he wasn't 100%. I mean, he was in charge, but Irvin Kershner really took that film on his own. Jedi, we didn't like as much because it seemed like he things backed up a little bit as far as quality. And then when the prequels came out, we were all going crazy. Oh boy, here they come. And then you had to sit there after Phantom Menace and you didn't want to come right out and say, I didn't really like it that much. But it was tough.
I have no memories of that film.
Right, obviously.
No memories of watching that movie in the movie theater. I've seen it so many times on DVD, but I definitely went to the movie theater a bunch of times to watch that, and I have no memory of it at all. So very strange. But,
they brought in J.J. Abrams to do Force Awakens, and of course he also did Rise of Skywalker, but it's obvious he didn't have total control, Rise of Skywalker. No. There are a number of interviews in which he talks about how things he wanted to do got shut down by Disney.
There was another director on that, and who had heard a great story, and it's on there, it's on the internet somewhere. The director actually put the story and screenplay that he had planned, and it would have made a much more exciting film.
But anyway, we could spend the whole hour talking about this, and we've already spent quite a bit, so let's move on. We're talking about Men on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. If I read what you were trying to say reasonably well in my reading, you were trying to talk about films that have a distinct male audience or male contingent. Is that basically where I was right about?
Yeah, definitely. I talk about in that chapter, first of all, I start with the bachelor party, which interestingly enough, me and you actually did talk about the bachelor party on a podcast. I think it was for the Dirty Dancing episode. And we actually did discuss this particular essay, which is really quite weird. So I start with the bachelor party, which is a 1984 Tom Hanks movie. Very misogynistic, but certainly elements of racism and stereotyping in there. And I start with that film just because it's my way in, basically. Like, this film was a film that I watched when I was a kid, to almost to the point where the VHS tape destroyed itself. And that's what I talk about in the opening of that chapter, is because it was almost like an exorcism, getting this film out of my system, watching it so many times that I basically destroyed it. And I've rarely ever gone back to it. But when I was obviously like a kid, when I was late on, I mean, I was young when I watched this film. I was probably younger than I should have been to watch this movie. But for whatever reason, my parents thought that because it had Tom Hanks in, it must be wholesome. And this was an early Tom Hanks movie when he was still just coming off TV and going into movies. So, yeah, there's quite a lot of sex in there. There's not a lot of nudity, but there is a little bit. All of this didn't bother me at all as a kid. I was more interested in the humor. And and so over the years, this VHS tape, which contained this taped version of the bachelor party, is just being slowly chewed up by my top loader VHS machine, but then is also being kind of corrupted by my own sort of messing around with the remote control and things like that. So I wanted to open that chapter with a personal kind of experience of a male film. And then we kind of launch into discussing four movies that are all by female directors. So there is American Psycho, Point Break, Hump Day, and Old Joy. And two of those films, I would sort of say, are from more or less the mainstream, Point Break and American Psycho. And then the other two are kind of more from the indie cinema scene, low budget, not as well-known actors, probably. And, just kind of have a bit of a slower story unfolding. And I was really interested in what a female perspective on male friendship or male... what you mentioned there, dominance, and how that plays out from a female perspective. And so I was really kind of intrigued to watch Point Break, because again, like one of my most favorite movies of when I was younger, and just sort of see that kind of homoeroticism that was kind of playing out in Point Break. And then also in Hump Day and Old Joy, there is also a sort of sense of homoeroticism, but also competitiveness as well. And that's kind of the driving story behind Hump Day, is actually two guys who can't back down from a bet end up convincing each other that they must have sex on film and enter it into a an adult movie festival. And they basically can't back down from each other. It's male competitiveness. And then in Old Joy, two friends who haven't seen each other for a while kind of go camping together. And there's a few moments there where one of the characters kind of maybe inappropriately kind of touches the other one, but the other one kind of lets it happen. And I just felt that that was an interesting perspective that a female director took that a male director would probably not have done. So, and then we move into that, the ending of that chapter, because we've talked a little bit about masculinity and toxic masculinity. We kind of move into Trump, and we kind of move into a book called The Scum Manifesto, which was written by Valerie Solanas 50 years before Trump's inauguration. And so it was quite fitting that those two things happened, because the description of the scum male in the Scum Manifesto perfectly aligns with a description of Trump, or a description of any of the horrible, disgusting men that we've kind of had to be had been dealing with in the past few years. Trump, Harvey Weinstein. When you read the Scum Manifesto, you realize that Valerie Solanas was 50 years ahead of all of this stuff. And it's a controversial book, but I feel like it's a necessary one to read in this current climate.
Of course, in 1971, all of these issues were still going on. It's just, as you say, it tended not to be discussed very much because it was still a male-dominated world, even if the major women's liberation movement had been going on by then for a while. One of the things I found so interesting about this chapter was the whole discussion of VHS, and it's one of those things that you talk about more than once in the book, and that's the idea of how these movies, or how our content is delivered. Back in the day, obviously pre-video recordings, the only way to see a film, there was two ways. You could see it in the theater, or you could hope that it showed up on television. Of course, if it showed up on television, at least in the United States, the good chance was it was going to be edited. Even unless it was a really old film, once the rating board started and films got to be a little more involved and weren't, because they were able to use the ratings to still end up presenting information without censorship. Once they showed up on television, they required editing. And of course, you mentioned in your discussion of Bachelor Party, you had said this was actually not just a VHS recording of it, but a VHS recording off of television. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even an original tape. Back when you were growing up, was Great Britain editing these films, or were they showing them as is?
No, they would have been editing these films, absolutely. I'm not sure if we had in the UK this thing called the watershed, which meant films shown before 9 p.m. would have to have language and nudity cut out of it. Then post-watershed, I think films would just go out as they were. But I got a feeling this was taped before the watershed, and I have a clear memory of even being in bed at the time, and my parents calling me down and saying, hey, there's a Tom Hanks movie on, do you want to come down and watch it, like come out of bed and watch it with us? And so that would have been before 9 p.m. So yeah, I think there was definitely some editing in there, not anything that I really noticed, but I think I saw the film on DVD a few years later, and it didn't really seem different, other than these kind of cues, which were on the VHS, where the film would be cut into with advertisements, you know, where all the catchy jingles and stuff like that would come on. And I think even maybe even a 5-minute newscast as well would usually come on as well. And those were missing from the DVD. And when I watched the DVD, I was like, you know, I saw those cues and then it just seamlessly cut to the next scene. And I was like, oh, there's something missing there. And then obviously I'd been very juvenile with the TV zapper, and I'd cut lots of little scenes into the videotape from, like, you know, tennis matches and things like that from Wimbledon in like 1990 or something like that. I don't know. And so I was expecting all these things to happen and they never did. So it was quite cool because I kind of had this individual copy, individual idea of what the film was in my head, which I don't think we have anymore. I think film is streamed now and we don't really have those physical formats that can be, you know, can be damaged, can be manipulated. We all have the same film on our devices. It all comes to us in the same way. Edited, it doesn't need editing anymore. You know, you can watch a film at any time of the day. So it's interesting. There's obviously an element of nostalgia there. I want to sort of go back to those times, but I'm also hooked into having the convenience of streaming. But man, do I spend a good half hour to 40 minutes searching for something to watch rather than actually just being presented with something to watch, which was when, you know, when you had TV, you looked down the listings and you saw the film was on at like 9 p.m. on Friday night. That was your plan. I'm going to watch that at 9 p.m. on Friday. And now it's like, I scroll through the, I've got like four different streaming services and I stream through them all before I finally find one thing that I will watch. And usually it's something that I've already seen, so I'm already familiar with it. But yeah, occasionally it will happen where I will watch something brand new and be absolutely swept away with.
Of course, in the United States, and I'm presumably Canada, I don't know what the TV situation really is like in Great Britain, but we have all these, you know, we have huge amounts of channels, and yet there are regular cable channels that still show films with commercials and everything. I mean, TBS, TNT, I mean, it's every weekend, it's nonstop superhero Marvel films, and yet they all have commercials in them, and yet you want to ask yourself, who's watching them? I mean, especially like Marvel and Star Wars, there's absolutely no reason. You can spend a few bucks on Disney Plus, and then if you live in the United States, and you can watch them uncut and stuff, and yet they obviously must be getting some amount of viewers because they keep doing it. They never seem to change.
Well, yeah, that's a really good point. But I also have to sort of raise, like, what's the difference? You know, watching a Marvel movie is like watching an advertisement with so much product placement in there anyway. What's the difference if a bunch of, you know, adverts show up every 40 minutes to break up the narrative, you know? So, I don't know what the difference is really. But anyway, I think obviously streaming is our future and I'm hooked into it. But I wish I could be more decisive and just go ahead and watch the new films that come on the device.
Well, let's both stop acting like we're old and let's move on to another chapter. All-American Tragedy, which is about the American Pie movies. We're talking the four actual feature films, not the direct-to-video material that continued on. What's interesting is when you start writing that chapter, I started to read it and I said, I'm not sure I get it. Is he joking at the beginning? But the more I read it, and I said, no, you actually have a serious point you're making in the way you describe those films, especially the first one. Talk a little bit about how you developed your personal ideas about particularly of the first one, but then of course the entire series.
Yeah, so I mean, it's been a while actually. That chapter, well, that essay appears in the book pretty much as it appeared back in 2014 when it was published online somewhere. I think it was published in a magazine called Gadfly, which I think is still around. I'm not sure if it still produces new stuff, but it's there somewhere. And I don't know. I guess I was sort of thinking, initially, I had no ideas about the American Pie franchise because each movie is a, you know, kind of I mean, I hold them to my close to my heart because I was of a similar age to the boys in the film when it actually came out in 99. You know, I was, I guess 18, 19 years old. The characters in that film are around about that age, although the actors are actually much older. So I have a certain affection for those films, especially the first one. But it really wasn't until like The Reunion came out, which I believe came out in 2012, that I was like, oh, there's something quite interesting here. Because when you look at the original film, you kind of, first of all, it's set in a period of time which we all kind of look back on with some, sense of nostalgia and sense of wonder of that period of time, the late 90s, where it was before 9/11, it was before the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. It was before the financial crash, and we could just keep going on. It was before Trump. It was before Brexit. The last 20 years has been, kind of exhausting. And I feel like when you look back at the 90s, it was probably no different, really, than it was. We were just younger, that's all. And I was obviously a teenager in the 90s and having the time of my life. So, didn't have adult responsibilities to consider. So that's kind of why I look back on it so fondly. When The Reunion kind of came out, we're talking sort of like 13, 14 years after the original. And the characters are not really where you would have expected them to be. So when you kind of look at the original film, you got the four characters. So you have Jim, Kevin, Chris, and Finch, and you also on the periphery of that group as well, you have Stifler, and that's the main focus of the film. I mean, there are female characters in there as well, but really it's those four boys and Stifler on the periphery, and then later in the franchise, Stifler becomes a bit more of a main character. But they've got a lot of things going for them. They're from fairly wealthy middle class backgrounds. They're all white, they've all got their quirks, but they're fairly popular in school. Jim's kind of a nerd, Paul Finch is kind of a nerd, as is Kevin, and then you've got Chris Ostreicher, who's this kind of sporty popular one who kind of brings them in to the fold, I suppose, of being popular in their kind of class or in their school. And you kind of feel like, these guys are going to do well. They got some eccentricities. Paul Finch, for example, they refer to him as Shipbreak because he likes to leave school to go and use his own bathroom as opposed to the one in the school. But he has a sense of worldliness about him that probably wasn't, for a teenager, he has he's a connoisseur of good coffee and things like that. And you kind of expect them all to go good places. Stifler is a guy who we see to be incredibly popular and incredibly rich. And, and then when we join them in the reunion, Jim is married to Michelle. They're basically exhausted parents. Chris was a sports star and now is like a sports caster for like a cable sports channel. Stifler, who we first sort of see as kind of strolling around this office, like giving out orders at this what looks like a sort of tech startup or something like that, but then he turns out he's actually just the intern. And Paul Finch, the kind of eccentric coffee connoisseur, the one who seemed very worldly, who was going to do great things, maybe become a writer or something like that, is an assistant manager at Staples, the stationery store. Nothing wrong with being an assistant manager at Staples. It's just maybe not what we didn't envision for him and maybe what he didn't envision for himself. And I think like when you look at the reunion in the sort of like post 9/11, the war was obviously still going on, but the post kind of that main part of the war, the post-mission accomplished, and the post-crash as well. You kind of see that neoliberalism, capitalism has kind of expanded to the point where it eats its own. You know, even the kids that were going to do well have kind of like fallen down because the system wasn't there to hold them up anymore. You know, they've somehow along the line, they've lost their status as good, clean, all-American white boys, you know? And I just kind of felt that film put a real sort of stab in the heart of what we were all probably expecting to be at that age as well. You know, I was maybe expecting to be something and somewhere different as well. But, you know, I maybe was thinking I was going to be traveling the world. And, but, you know, life catches up with you and it catches up with these guys as well. And they weren't immune to it. They weren't immune to the sort of onflux of neoliberalism post-crash where it had to, you know, eat its own children, basically, in order to survive. And that circle is just getting smaller and smaller as we're all being kind of jettisoned out. So the middle class is now, you know, the middle class has become the working class and the working class is the underclass. Now all that's left is just the upper echelons, the billionaires and the tech wealthy millionaires, I suppose. So it's quite a sad sort of idea, but I think it just ties in with where we all ended up, you know, post 9/11, post crash.
Yeah, the one issue to me with the first film, and I'm not the first person to say this, but it has become pretty much a topic of discussion when we talk about teenage sex comedies, is the scenes where they try to put the exchange student over the internet without her knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And we run into that with other films that got good reputations for being enjoyable during the period. Revenge of the Nerds is another one. And it's mm-hmm. probably the one part. And although in the end, he gets his comeuppance, the fact that they were actually going to do it is one of the negatives, which unfortunately, I agree with you. The idea that the film actually is anti-athlete, if you think about it, there's only mm-hmm. one athlete of the group. And mm-hmm. in the end, he doesn't go to his game. He ends up going to the choral.
And he's also the only one who doesn't lose his virginity that night as well.
So there was no yeah. question that the filmmaker was trying to come at things with it a little different way. And I guess the fact that there's a lot of raunchiness is at first glance makes it harder to see those kind of things. But in the end, I agree with you. There are certainly an attempt to show things differently.
Yep.
And even with a storyline that's probably been used in some way, shape, or form a number of times, but the concept mm-hmm. at least of trying to get having sex for the first time as you graduate.
Yeah, yeah.
So, as I say, we've talked about only three chapters and we've been on for almost an hour, but so obviously there's plenty of others. You delve back in with Dennis Hopper in a chapter and talk about mm-hmm. David Lynch as well with that chapter. You've got a whole chapter about Nicolas Cage, a number of other chapters. There's one about disaster films, more current ones, starting with Deep Impact and Armageddon, which came out almost at the same time, both mm-hmm. basically planning on destroying the world. One succeeds, at least to an extent. The other one, they're saved. But let's talk about your afterword, because that was obviously one of the more current things, and it's your discussion of you know, entertainment and film in the current pandemic period. What was your what did you want to cap the book off by saying?
Yeah, I guess you know, there's obviously elements in the book which are a little pessimistic, and that just comes from, you know, the film culture that we kind of exist in right now. So I wanted to sort of like take the idea of the pandemic and how it has affected film and kind of try and make a positive spin on it. You know, in the past year, obviously, I mean, I live in a relatively small city. I've got this amazing movie theater downtown. It's small. It only seats about maybe 100 people per screen. But right now, obviously, they can only seat about 20, you know, with social distancing, mask compliance and things like that. So they're struggling. They're having a hard time. And but what kind of happened and what was really positive is, you know, the kind of the community around the movie theater kind of came together, and there was donation runs and things like that. And they've got about, you know, they've got another year of time to sort of adjust to this new normal that we keep hearing about. So I wanted to kind of like make a positive case for films and kind of like the access that we now have, because film festivals are happening online. So a film festival like, well, you know what, maybe not like the Cannes Film Festival. Maybe I can't attend that virtually, but my downtown one, the Kingston Canadian Film Festival that happened back in April, I believe, you know, was all virtual, and they had the best attendance they'd ever had. They had people from Paris, Ontario, and Paris, France attending. You know, this is actually really quite remarkable that we have new films that are being screened at film festivals that usually maybe we couldn't attend because we would have to travel, or, you know, maybe we'd have to even leave the country. Maybe they weren't even showing even in our region. But now we have this incredible access. And I really hope what kind of happens, and this is what I talk about in the book, is that we kind of have this kind of hybrid version, even when the pandemic is over and we can go all and sit in movie theaters together again. I think it would still be really wonderful for people to still have from all around the world to kind of access film through this method, because we're all used to it now as well. Like, we've all been streaming films on our laptops for the past, I don't know, like 10 years, really, maybe even more. You know, we're all there. The only thing that I do obviously feel a bit sad for is, you know, the multiplex kind of as it exists and maybe won't exist anymore, because we're all out of the habit of going to the big movie theaters now. I mean, I went to one a few weeks ago and had a pretty good time, but I mean, it was me and my son and then maybe three other families in this vast auditorium watching Space Jam, you know. It doesn't really need to happen that way anymore. So maybe the multiplex dies, replaced by smaller movie theaters or different viewing experiences. I've always really enjoyed watching films in different places, like art galleries or even outside. You know, we have a big square downtown, which accommodates a really big screen. And they've had, you know, Thursday night movies in the square, and it's been fantastic. So maybe we do that. And then maybe Hollywood and mainstream movies don't need to spend billions of dollars making and promoting these, making and marketing these immense movies, Marvel, Star Wars movies. Maybe we don't need those so much anymore if they can be small, if we can make smaller, more engaging films about what it means to be human, what it means to live in a community like the one that I live in. Maybe we can make more, you know, films that are regionally based as opposed to these big international money-making movies. I'd love to get back to, you know, film as art. And it's happened before, you know, we've had movements within cinema. We've had the new Hollywood films of the 1960s and 70s. We've had mumblecore, which was a little subgenre of independent film, which films like Hump Day and Old Joy and, you know, those very small, intimate films kind of came out of. And I think that would just be really wonderful to kind of go back there. So the afterword of the book kind of does point us in that direction. And I hope that readers of the book who are film lovers and film goers take some away from that. But if filmmakers as well read that chapter and they maybe think to themselves, you know, maybe I don't need to make this vast budget movie. Maybe I can just go out with my video camera and record my community and make stories within my local region or my local area. There's always stuff going on. And yeah, so that's kind of where the Afterward takes us.
Well, it's funny because I think that was already starting to happen pre-pandemic when you think about first Netflix to a large extent, but then just about every other, all, not just about, all the streaming services now have their own in-house productions, or they buy feature films that maybe show up in a theater briefly just to qualify them for an Academy Award. But other than that, or any other kind of award, but in the end, that's the way they're known. And just about every major filmmaker now doesn't even think twice about doing it. I mean, Marty Scorsese did the Irishman, and a number of other major filmmakers who you at first thought wouldn't have think they would do it ended up doing it. And a lot of these were obviously pre-pandemic. And the fact that so many of these are winning awards, both television awards and movie awards, tells us that I think, even if it wasn't planned that way originally, the pandemic has really helped that take off. And now it's just a matter of seeing how it goes forward. I think the financing issues and the fact that right now, at least in some of these films, the international box office is so important, particularly China and some of the other countries, that we're still going to see certain films they're going to release into the theaters because they want to make sure they get that, that box office. But, it will be, unfortunately, there's a whole issue related to when you accept money from international companies, it definitely affects the actual filmmaking, and that's a whole subject all by itself. But anyway, I think we're going to definitely see, I mean, and in each case, like I say, Star Wars and Marvel had already started to plan out their TV series before pandemic hit. It's just, and in fact, what's actually happened is it's the movies that were delayed, not the TV series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, as we kind of move into this kind of post-pandemic world, you know, there's already films coming out in the next few years, like The Batman, and they're going to be hitting streaming as well as being released to the movie theater. And I just think that's a really great thing, you know, because it gives people more access, I suppose. People who may not be able to be vaccinated against this disease can still go and watch a movie. And just to like put a little postscript on, you know, I'm still super, super excited about the next Star Wars movies, the next Marvel movies. I saw the trailer for the Matrix, new Matrix movie that's coming out. And like, it still gives me that like tingle up the spine. And, you know, I'm not dissing the big films, but I think that there's room now to have in our culture these smaller movies that can do better because we just have the access now. We have access to film festivals that hybrid themselves across the world, so that you know you have in-person attendance and online attendance, and we have just a ton of really great streaming services like Canopy and the Criterion channel and things like that, you know. And so it's good in a way, but you know, the content is obviously massive, and that's a kind of a key word, is content. I don't want to see content anymore. I just want to see movies.
Funny part about it is the other thing that streaming has given us is, depending on your willingness, you can put together a much better viewing and sound system than some of the movie theaters. And especially when you think that watching a film in a theater can be a great experience, but if the projections, I mean, if the, like, I, it's always been my feeling that the digital, and maybe it's just the movie theaters I'm going to, not that I've been to any for a while, they always seem darker than they need to be. And when you're at home and you're with your own television and sound system, things can look so much better. But and I think that's just a Hollywood thing, or not just Hollywood, every place. They just need to work hard. If they really want to keep movie theaters going, they can't let them become second rate or second nature, that no matter what, not going to want to go to the theater because their experience isn't as good.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the technology has been democratized. You know, I carry around with me a pretty decent video camera, you know, in my pocket, And editing software is free online. So, you know, we've got no excuses anymore. You know, when I was filmmaking back in the mid 2000s, you know, camera equipment was a few hundred. Well, I was in the UK, so a few hundred pounds, and Adobe editing software and stuff like that was a couple hundred as well. Yeah, now it's just not even necessary. So,
and the other part is that the streaming services, depending on your television, have now reached the point where with 4K, they are getting almost the same now as what you would see in a movie theater. 4K is, you know, we're reaching the point now where the difference between 4K and whatever would be next may well be negligible. And that's something that never, obviously we've gotten to that point. And I'll, you know, to me, I think that makes it even more exciting to be able to, the home viewing experiences can be so much interesting.
Absolutely.
So, well, we've talked about this book. We've only given it a taste, but I think it's a good taste. Hopefully what we talked about with the various chapters we discussed were interesting to the listener. And I hope you feel like we've discussed the book well enough to not just sell it, but also to give a good sense as to what's included in it and yep. what kind of writing people can look forward to, not only from this book, but whatever other writing you do. And then whatever future books are in coming forward, that they continue to get a good sense of what you want to say about film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Joel.
So I appreciate the time, and I hope things go well. And once again, we'll probably talk again in the future. Thanks a lot.
Let's hope so. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me, Stephen. I found your essays to help give a view of various films along with your own personal experiences with them. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.